This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. New York Governor Eliot Spitzer resigned today. The resignation will take effect on Monday to allow Lieutenant Governor David Patterson time to plan a transition. Spitzer succumbed to pressure to step down after revelations of his being caught up with prostitution, allegedly hiring high-priced call girls through a service called Emperor's Club VIP.
Though prostitution is illegal, cheating on your spouse is not. Many companies are finding that infidelity can bring in big profits. Day to Day's Alex Cohen reports on one Toronto-based company that's made millions helping people cheat.
The Ashley Madison Agency isn't subtle in its marketing. The website's motto is, "Life is short, have an affair."
AshleyMadison.com is the world's largest service of its kind, catering to men and women already in relationships but in need of something more.
Their radio ads even recommend cheating on the company dime.
When you have a private moment at work today, remember to visit AshleyMadison.com. You'll be happy you came.
The ad sounded pretty interesting, and I thought maybe I'd give it a shot and see if I could get any action.
Don is a 52-year-old IT specialist living in Southern California. He didn't want his real last name used in this story in case his wife was listening. Online, he goes by the handle Don DeShizzle, where he says he's looking for an NSA, or no strings attached, relationship. So far, Don says he's paid about $100 to email an instant message with other Ashley Madison members.
What you do is you buy credits, I think 100 credits at a time, for like $55, and then each email that you initiate costs you like 5 credits. You burn through them pretty quickly.
Don says he likes the site because it gives him the opportunity to be upfront about his marital status.
Because I guess all the cards are on the table. It's not like if you go to a single or a standard site, then you kind of have the stigma of being a cheater. That doesn't seem right.
Don says he doesn't feel too ethically troubled by what he's doing, though he also says he hasn't met anyone in person yet. As for the people profiting from the Ashley Madison website, they say they have no moral qualms either.
This is just a business to me. This is a market need, much like any other business that's successful. There is huge demand for it.
Chief Operating Officer Noel Biederman says the online business has made more than $20 million since they started in 2002. Biederman is himself married with children. He says he's faithful to his wife, but that choice isn't for everyone.
This is just a fact of life. Monogamy is not in our DNA.
In fact, Biederman goes so far as to claim that a little infidelity may do a person good. He says it can help people reclaim a sense of self-worth.
Women come to a service like Ashley Madison because they haven't been sent roses or flowers in God knows how long. Valentine's Day gets forgotten. That revalidation comes in a female user on our site within 30 or 40 minutes, has a number of guys kind of knocking at her door and professing their desire to meet with her.
Of course, Biederman is not an expert in marital relations, but Framingham State College sociology professor Virginia Rutter is. She says there's nothing wrong with having a vivid sexual imagination.
It's great to have a relationship that can tolerate and actually support and enjoy the fact that partners will flirt, will be interested in other people.
What's not great, says Rutter, is lying to your partner or spouse and secretly conducting outside relationships.
That kind of injury, that kind of loss of trust is going to make either your breakup or your continuing your relationship a lot harder to conduct.
Rutter says she isn't surprised by the popularity of websites like Ashley Madison.
It reminded me of this song from the 1970s called If You Like Pina Colada.
I was tired of my lady. We'd been together too long. Like a worn-out recording of a favorite song.
A guy who's bored in his relationship advertises for someone who likes pina coladas and getting caught in the rain. I'm so embarrassed. I know all the lyrics still. And at the end, the punchline is that when he meets up with the person he's found through the personal ads, the person is his actual partner, and they reignite their connection.
In real life, Rutter says, chances are things won't turn out quite as rosy if someone already in a relationship goes trolling for excitement online. Her advice? Why not invest that time and energy in the existing relationship and look for ways to spice it up instead? Alex Cohen, NPR News.
There was no shortage of computer science fans on hand this week in Austin, Texas. The city's South by Southwest Interactive Festival wrapped last night after five eventful days. There were a few surprising keynote speeches, and let's not forget the panels with names like A Better Gun to Shoot Your Eye Out With and Kill Your Mouse, Kinetic Computing. Omar Gayaga covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman. He spent more time thinking and living tech this week than most of us will in a lifetime, which is exactly why we keep him around. Omar, it is always good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
I want to begin with some of these keynote speakers. Mark Zuckerberg, that 23-year-old billionaire founder of Facebook, appeared at the festival. Did he reveal any secrets about Facebook's future?
Very little. He was really here at the conference to try to get developers excited about creating applications for Facebook. So it wasn't Facebook coming out and saying, we've got a cool application that does this or we've got a cool application that does that. Right now, they're really focused on growing users and getting developers to do the work of creating the cool games or the cool social networking apps or things that will excite users and keep them around.
And they allow users to connect online. That's what's helped that company stand out. Likewise, there's this website called postsecret.com. We've actually talked about this site here on this program a few years ago when it first appeared, but it's clearly grown and almost exploded since then. And I understand its founder, Frank Warren, hosted a rather unusual and emotional panel.
Frank Warren was one of the keynote speakers, and yes, he delivered what I thought was the high point of the festival, the website posts secrets that people send in on postcards. And, you know, sometimes they're very short, funny messages. Sometimes they're very deep, dark secrets. But you get in just a few words some very profound sentiments, some very deep emotional things. And Frank Warren himself is an excellent speaker. He also brought up some people on stage to reveal secrets live. And that was really the emotional high point of the whole event. He had one person who proposed to his girlfriend from the stage, and she said yes.
So this was just spontaneous? He called people, said, does anybody have a secret they'd like to share?
Yeah, people kind of got in line as they came in and went on stage. One woman who actually had just had lunch with and had no idea that she had the secret, she revealed that her sister is very, very sick. She had already gone through cancer and leukemia, and she was worried that her sister might die during the festival.
Sounds like almost like a tent revival there at the South by Southwest Festival.
It was you had people walking out in tears. You had people very, you know, emotionally choked up. I mean, it was very, I'm getting a little choked up now just talking about it. It was very a profound and moving experience and really a good contrast to a lot of the rest of the festival, which is focused on venture capital and raising money and how do you make a business out of blogging. This was a much more of a human side to technology, something that really puts a human face on these things that we kind of take for granted now, these tools that are online.
Now, for people who do rely on technology every day, there was a profound question that was considered at the conference, and that was this question of whether or not to kill your mouse.
Yeah, there is a lot of new interfaces for how we communicate with computers. The Nintendo Wii is one example. Instead of having, you know, a game controller that's tethered to a console, you have this thing that you move around in the air, and there's, you know, the Guitar Hero phenomenon where, you know, you're not playing with a game controller, you're playing with a guitar. And Microsoft has a project called Surface that is a touchscreen table. So there's a lot of question about whether these are going to be the interfaces of the future, if we'll be communicating with computers with our hands and our movements and our eyeballs or even our brainwaves. You know, you could think something and there it is on screen. But interestingly, some of the people on the panel believe that the mouse and the keyboard are still pretty grade-A tools.
Omar, it's always good to talk to you. Take care.
Thank you, Michelle. Have a good Wednesday.
That was Omar Gayaga. He covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman. And the South by Southwest Festival transforms today from a tech conference to a music festival. And NPR coverage starts tonight with a live concert from REM. You can visit npr.org/music for details.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Congress heard an appeal this morning for a four-point plan to secure U.S. leadership in technology innovation, strengthen education, revamp immigration, fund more basic research, and encourage private sector R&D. Those four goals were spelled out for the House Committee on Science and Technology by Bill Gates. The chairman of Microsoft says the United States' position as the global leader in innovation is at risk. Well, after Bill Gates testified, he came by our studios to talk with our co-host, Robert Siegel.
Mr. Gates, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
One recent undertaking by Microsoft bespeaks several of the problems that you spoke about today, and that was the company opening a facility in Vancouver, British Columbia, a place where Microsoft can bring people near headquarters but over the Canadian border, people who can't get H-1B visas to work in the United States, if I have that right. Why can't you just put Americans doing those jobs on the U.S. side of the border instead?
Well, the good news is that we are hiring people in the United States at a very rapid rate. And, you know, our success allows us to do more in research and grow employment. The thing that limits us is hiring the world's best engineers. 60% of the students at the top U.S. universities are foreign-born, and we compete with others to hire those people. In the past, they were allowed to stay in the United States, but now that these quotas have been hit, they have to leave the country. And so in some cases, we take them to Vancouver, where you've got a government that welcomes not only those people for these high-paying jobs, but the four or five jobs we create around each of those engineers.
Just to clarify, though, foreign-born covers many different conditions. It includes people whose families immigrated to the United States and who grew up here but were born in Taiwan or Ukraine or wherever. We were talking about people who are actually here temporarily who account for a majority
right.
of the people in graduate programs?
Yeah, the top computer science departments in the United States are 60% people who are not citizens. Traditionally, most of them stay in the country and jobs are created around them. Now that we've hit these visa quotas, they have to go somewhere else.
Whatever it is, if 65,000 of those visas are given in a year, that's it, no more.
Right. And what happened was in April, the minute it was opened up, they were all used up. So anybody graduating in June couldn't be in that pool because they didn't have their degree yet. And so they're all out of luck. And they're going to get a job. These are our great computer scientists, and they all have many, many job offers in many different countries.
I want to play an exchange from this morning's congressional hearing when Congressman Dana Rohrabacher of California was questioning you about jobs in America that are not filled by Americans.
These jobs are going begging, and the result is that in a competitive economy,
you'd have to raise wages.
No, we
in a competitive economy, if the jobs going begging, you raise wages. Now,
it's not an issue of raising wages. These jobs are very, very, very high paying jobs.
Okay.
We are hiring as many of these people as we can.
So my question is, if you threw in yet another if you offered a premium for American workers, could you find them, or are they simply not there?
We hire from the best schools, and all the people who go to those schools, we offer jobs to American, non-American. That's who we build these product teams around. And so because we're in a very competitive business, we don't compromise on that. Wherever we can get those people, that's where we create the jobs.
But there is a distinction between saying it's a global economy, there's a global labor force, and we feel as a global player we should be able to employ people at the best wages where we can find them if it's a matter of cost. That's different from saying, look, you just can't find them if they're native-born Americans educated at American University. There aren't enough people coming through.
We need people who've been educated in these top departments, and we will pay whatever it takes to hire those people. The salaries don't vary based on what country they're in. Right. These people are getting a job that with benefits is worth over $100,000 a year, no matter where they're doing the work.
Here's what a group that opposes you on all this, the Programmers Guild, through the very technology that you've helped develop all your life, they could be on the web with their own response to your testimony this morning. And they say this about H-1 visas. They say, you've used the H-1B program, I'm quoting now, to train a critical mass of foreign workers within the U.S. and then use these workers to establish overseas operations. They say, yep, our advantage is eroding, and the use of H-1Bs facilitates that erosion. What's wrong with that argument?
The people who
who are here on H-1B visas overwhelmingly want to stay in the country. And so these people go on to apply for a green card and, you know, be great taxpayers, stay here and have the jobs around them stay here. It is true that universities outside the United States, like Indian Institute of Technology, Tsinghua in China, they are seeing what the U.S. has done well with its universities, and they are getting better. But the good news is the U.S. universities are still the best, and our top goal is to hire the people who graduate from those schools, but because they're foreign-born, they're not allowed to stay in our country.
You're saying that when you do get to hire a foreign worker on an H-1B visa and bring that person into the United States, that has no negative consequence for American employment.
It has a positive consequence because of the jobs we create around that person.
There will be such jobs. It depends where
these people
where
will
the
be hired. They have many job offers. These people will work. The only question we can deal with is, do we allow them to stay here and work? And traditionally, the U.S., because it's so attractive, has had this huge advantage that other countries bemoan the fact that these smart people are moving here. Now they celebrate the fact that we're kicking them out after giving them the world's best education.
Mr. Gates, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
That's Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates speaking with our co-host, Robert Siegel.
One place where Microsoft has opened a research lab is China. Microsoft Research Asia, known as MSRA, was established in Beijing 10 years ago. Today it houses about 360 researchers. On my recent trip to China, I spent some time with one of them.
So actually our group is located this west ring of this false floor.
Tian Lu is 32 years old. He's been with Microsoft for 5 years. He's got a round face, glasses, and an outfit you'd see on any IT guy this side of the Pacific, slacks and a white and blue dress shirt, casual jacket. He works in a cubicle, and on his desk are a couple photos of his wife, a few books, and a tower of granite blocks.
Are those awards that are stacked up there?
These are patent awards from the Microsoft. Wow. Once I filed a patent, Microsoft will give us such a stone.
Thank you for your inventive contribution to Microsoft.
You have a lot of them.
Yes, I think I have more than 30. Some of our senior people, we joke that they can build a wall using those kind of patent awards.
Lu's research at Microsoft involves web searches. Currently, he's using algorithms to figure out how best to rank results.
So for internet search engine user, you know, it is definitely that the current search engines cannot really satisfy our information needs. You know, sometimes we can find quite a good answer, but sometimes we cannot. So I think there is a long way to go along this direction.
What's that like for you to know that people all over the world are using this in their daily life?
I would be very proud of that. Yeah. You know, we are inventing great technology and really people are using that. It's sometimes a luxury, you know. Not every researcher have this chance to do that kind of work, I think.
Lu says he's aware of the importance of the work he's doing, given the strength of Microsoft's rivals like Google and Yahoo. But he insists that as a researcher, he's not focused on the competition, but rather on his own research projects and on how best to collaborate with his colleagues in the U.S., whether by telephone, video conference, or in face-to-face meetings.
Because we really want to influence the production by presenting our technology to them, by provide our consultant. So I think within the company, there is a very good channel for us to collaborate with others, no matter in China or in U.S. or in U.K.
You know, a lot of time in companies, some of the most important business happens in the hallways. Mm-hmm. You know, you just happen to bump into somebody, and that's your aha moment, that you just happen to run into the right person at the right time. It's hard to do that if you're in one place and the person who might spark that aha moment is on the other side of the world.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the challenges. Yeah. So, you know, we travel a lot to the Renmin. At that time, I will try to talk to more people and use every chance to communicate with them, to know about their concerns and anything. So the distance is really a problem. But what we can do and we would like to do is to minimize the negative effect of that.
How often do you go back and forth?
Maybe once a month.
To Redmond once a month?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't.
When the project is really going to a critical timing, yeah. But sometimes when we are just brainstorming or planning, maybe not so frequent like that.
Thankfully for Liu, he has 5 interns working for his group, PhD students from China's best schools. Altogether, Microsoft Research Asia employs about 200 interns from around the world. I asked Liu whether the presence of Microsoft's research facility in China has benefited the country's universities. His answer was yes.
As far as I can remember, when the lab of Microsoft Research Asia was just established, local universities do not really have a huge presence in the world. For example, in the area of information retrieval, my area, I know there's no paper really published by Chinese researchers at that time. So after 10 years, I think if you look at the top conference and top journals of the information retrieval, you will see many papers written by Chinese professors and their students. And most possibly, these professors will have some kind of relationship with MSRA. Maybe some of their interns students helping interns here, or they have some collaborations with MSRA. So through this collaboration, we really have delivered what we have experienced to the local educational system. Yeah.
It sounds like there are new opportunities for people in your field that 10 years ago, 15 years ago, certainly 20 years ago, wouldn't be here.
I think it is certain that Microsoft has contributed something to this process, but I think China also grew very fast in these years. So from one point, we say Microsoft have contributed something, but from another point, I think there may be a trend. The universities in China really have more and more presence in the world, and they have really trained more and more very excellent students and really have influence in the world.
That's Tian Liu, a researcher in internet search technology. And one last note, we did ask what a Chinese researcher earns. Microsoft's response to us was, quote, "In part due to competition, it's Microsoft's policy to not disclose employees' salaries. We offer competitive salaries, including those in the area of research." From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Computer science programs around the country are facing an enrollment crisis. The number of students has plummeted since the end of the dot-com bubble. Some schools have half as many students entering computer studies as they did just a few years ago. NPR's Larry Abramson reports on the downturn and what's being done about it.
The University of Maryland in College Park is an example of just how badly interest in computer science has crashed. Jim Pertolo is associate chair of the department.
We went from somewhere around 2,200 majors around the turn of the millennium to somewhere under 600. So that's quite a fluctuation.
And that trend is reflected at other schools. Stuart Zwieben at the Ohio State Computer Science and Engineering Department recently surveyed schools on their CS enrollment. He says the problem was exacerbated by the bumper crop of computer science students who signed up in the late 1990s.
Students went into the programs in the late 90s. They got out in the early 2000s. And that was just the wrong time to get out.
Because the tech boom had busted by then. Zwieben says that collision of high graduation rates and poor job prospects led to the perception that computer science was a dead end. In fact, demand is strong, thanks to the growth of computer-related work in homeland security, genetics, and biotech. Computing associations are trying to get the word out that the job market is robust, but many in the field say they deal with other image problems. Jeanette Wing of the National Science Foundation says many young people picking a major think computer science will lead to a dreary life writing computer code.
There's a wrong impression that computer science is just computer programming. And in fact, computer science has a lot of breadth in the kind of activity that we do. ranging from, of course, theoretical computer science, algorithms and complexity theory, all the way to how do humans and computers work together.
The National Science Foundation is encouraging schools to revamp their programs so students will be attracted to an exciting, multifaceted discipline. Jeanette Wing says the NSF has been awarding grants to help schools with this task.
And to actually promote that you can major in computer science and do anything.
Wing says just as literature majors can become journalists, computer science graduates can choose any career they like. That is what the University of Maryland has been trying to do, and there are small signs of success. New computer science enrollments bottomed out a couple of years ago, and they've been slowly climbing. Pam Krolakowski will graduate from Maryland's computer science department this year. She says many young people still shy away from the field because they think it will mean social death.
That computer scientists and people in the computing field tend to be really antisocial, which is not the case. A lot of our projects are in groups. There are still those few people who would rather spend their whole day in front of the computer, but there's many of us who don't want to do that.
Krolakowski's presence at Maryland is a symbol of another struggle facing the field.
I'm not the only woman in most of my classes. I'm one of the few.
The number of women getting computer science degrees continues to decline, and it remains a small fraction of the number of men in the field. Computer scientists say by the time women get to college, it's probably too late to lure them in. They say attitudes need to change where they are formed, probably in middle school. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Boeing has formally protested the awarding of a lucrative contract awarded by the U.S. Air Force to a rival group that included a European jet manufacturer. Boeing claims the bidding and evaluation process was seriously flawed and unfair. Its workers and the company's supporters on Capitol Hill remain incensed that the Air Force chose what they call a French plane over an American one. But as NPR's Wendy Kaufman explains, today's large aircraft are global products, and it would be hard to find one made in a single country.
When Boeing began making planes for the military 90 years ago, it was a quintessential American company. Today, it's a global one. Boeing boasts that its newest and most sophisticated jet, the 787, is being developed by an international team of aerospace companies. Most of the parts are being made abroad. Even the tanker that it proposed to build for the Air Force had about 15% foreign content, as industry analyst Scott Hamilton explains.
The fuselage is built in Japan, the tail is built in Italy, and other components are built in the UK.
The team that won the tanker project includes Northrop Grumman and EADS, the corporate parent of Airbus. Their plane will be built in France, with major parts from Spain, Germany, and Britain. It will be assembled in Alabama with General Electric engines made in Ohio.
Evandale, Ohio.
That's veteran defense industry analyst Lauren Thompson.
There's no such thing anymore as a complex product that is only built in one place. Almost invariably, whether it's an aircraft or it's an automobile or it's a piece of electronic equipment, the parts come from all over the world. You know, the irony of living in a globalized economy is even when you think you're buying a domestic product, a lot of the time you're really not.
Globalization in Boeing's supply chain is driven by many factors: geopolitics, costs, expertise, and a desire to share the financial risk with outside partners. Back in the 1990s, for example, when China began buying lots of Boeing jets, the Chinese government wanted something in return, and they got deals to build Boeing planes. Today, Boeing sells billions of dollars in aircraft overseas, and here's where free trade butts up against protectionism. Boeing workers and the company's allies on Capitol Hill are furious that Boeing didn't get the tanker deal. They note correctly that the Boeing plane would have resulted in substantially more American jobs. But these same individuals don't complain when Boeing wins huge contracts to sell planes abroad. And says Professor Stephen Coburn of the Wharton School,
if we expect other countries' borders to be open to our products, then we have to open our borders to theirs. If we start to close our borders, then we have to expect they'll close theirs.
Boeing's protest of the tanker award is not based on the number of American jobs it would have created or an overall benefit for the U.S. economy, things the Air Force was not supposed to consider. Rather, the appeal is based on what Boeing calls a seriously flawed process. But no matter what happens with the appeal, congressional sentiment to buy American, or at least buy the most American product available, runs deep, and the debate over the tanker project is far from over. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
Thank you.